officers. There are now only one hearings officer because of budget cuts, so it becomes more difficult. I challenged, as an attorney in private practice, the time limits in habeas corpus hearings on when a preliminary hearing must be held in parole and probation violation hearings. The research that I did indicated that 15 days was the quickest time period that I found required anywhere in the United States, and that was by statute, as I recall, in Pennsylvania and under the U.S. Parole Commission rules. In the cases that dealt with that, it generally held that 30 days was the optimum reasonable period. There were some that held that 60 days was as much, you know, maybe okay, but generally the weight of authority that I saw was that a period of about 30 days was acceptable for holding the preliminary hearing. Now, as a defense attorney, I would like, to see the people have their hearings within 15 days. As a practical matter, I share with you my experience as a parole board hearings officer. I don't know that that can be done, and I think that constitutionally that a 30-day time period would be acceptable. I would like to indicate, as far as from the corrections and detention committee perspective, Section 27 is one which is very consistent with the Bar Committee's position of looking for alternatives to incarceration and supports that. Finally, I just want to address Section 28, which limits the appeals to the Court of Appeals from and actually eliminates it where a guilty plea has been entered. The concern that I have in that area is that while there may be little substantively to appeal, there are some instances such as restitution orders, conditions of probation, which currently may be appealed. As I read this, those matters would no longer be appealable under that particular section. I've been involved in a number of cases where we've had successful appeals from restitution amounts that were ordered, seeming, incorrect. It seems that where you are going to make the restitution have the effect of a civil judgment, where a judge can follow, where you're entitled to a hearing and where a judge will make findings as to a suitable amount of restitution, in that one example, frequently that's after a guilty plea, it will discourage working out cases where the issue is not guilt, but it is what is the extent of culpability here, if there's no appeal from that. Similarly, if a judge imposes a condition of probation which is not perhaps warranted or imposes some kind of, which by court decisions is not may not even be legal, there's no recourse if we cannot appeal anything following a guilty plea. I finally would point out that Section 30, which clarifies the appeals from parole board orders, becomes increasingly important is essential in light of the limited appeals of substantive review of sentencing and the fact that the parole board, the effect of the parole board rules, it becomes critical to the application of the prison term. There needs to be a review of that.
Needs to be what?
There needs to be effective review.
Yes,
of parole.
Yes, absolutely. Sure. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Questions? Mark, thank you for coming out of your position. Let's see. Judith, you're here from out of town. Are you still here? She was here a minute ago. I was going to try to. Is Judith gone?
I think she just got back to make a phone call.
She said to just go ahead.
Let's see. Stevie? Then I want to take, before we adjourn, I think I'd like to try to take, let me just ask who else is going to be able to come back. I'd like to We have the Corrections Division testimony. Billy Watson is here, the ODAA, the defense lawyers, the Department of Justice. So we've still got a ways to go.
I can come back.
Could you come back, Steve? I mean, okay. It'll be 2:15 next Tuesday. Did Judith come back in? I didn't notice her. Is she gone for today? Okay. Let's take the Corrections Division while you're here. Bob, do you want to bring your entire group up if you're all in collaboration?
Chairman, for the record, I'm Bob Watson, Administrator of the Corrections Division. View of the hour, I'll be very brief. We have some material, I think, that the committee should consider with regard to mandatory minimum terms, which had expressed interest in the practices of the courts in imposing those terms and the growth in the practice around the state, which I think is carries with it, I guess, the implication that it's something worth looking at to see whether or not we need to include how it's considered in relation to this bill. I don't have any particular quarrel, I guess, with the use of the mandatory minimum on a very dangerous offender, such as the one Judge Bloombrake discussed. But you see, in examining that material, that we have individuals for theft and vehicle theft and forgery and a lot of other statute offenses who receive these mandatory minimum terms also, and which are in large part upheld by the parole board. They do overturn some, but the majority are upheld. And those that go beyond the matrix, we had 230 of them in 1982, and all of those were either upheld in full or partially upheld, so they extended the time beyond the matrix. So I think in spite of the fact there's philosophical disagreements in practice, the board pretty much stays with the excess time when it goes above the matrix because the facts are there. They find out somehow or another that these are exceptional cases, and where they had 230 opportunities to do something else, they didn't. They upheld the judge's opinion on 163 of the 230 and split the difference with the court on the other 67. They just went halfway between the top of the matrix and what the judge had imposed. So. If I had a recommendation to make, it would be to perhaps limit the use of the mandatory minimum to Class A felonies or to those where there's violence or threat of violence to other people. And I think we ought to take a hard look at those instances where the mandatory minimum is used on these statute offenses or those where there is not potential harm to other people, because the prison beds are scarce. And just as a rough estimate, I think I told this committee a couple months ago that we estimated between consecutive sentences and mandatory minimums, we have about 600 beds filled with those people now. So it's having a substantial impact, and we need to look at that. The time frames on the pre-sentence reports and the parole violations, we think we can meet those deadlines, Mr. Chairman. We've had some very careful discussion of the ideas. The parole violation in particular, which was just mentioned by Mark Sussman, as I recall the U.S. Supreme Court ruling, it said any officer other than the one directly providing supervision could conduct those hearings. So it's our plan to assist the parole board in that matter by assigning other staff who are not supervising to assist. And it is a matter of great importance to the jails, because these people are held in jails until the hearings are conducted. And I think the way the law is written, we can meet those deadlines. So I want to make sure. Yes.
Well, I recall in earlier hearings that I raised the question: is there any reason why the judiciary couldn't hold those hearings? Is there any reason why they couldn't?
Not that I'm aware of.
So
I guess their workload, I guess, would be.
As I recall, though, it was a fairly simple determination that is to be made.
I guess in 90% of the instances, we ask the individual, do you want a full-blown hearing, or you waive that, and can we transport you back to the prison? They say yes. Fact's pretty clear. So it's a very brief kind of thing, but it does require a certain record to be maintained and certain rights to be read, and you have to follow a certain form. But we're now developing those for the use of our staff to try to take some of that load off of jails. We think we can do it without asking the courts to take it on.
Would it take statutory authorization to allow judges to hear those matters? Or would you do that or by administrative? You know, we probably have to do authorize it by statute, wouldn't we?
I guess. That's really all I had, Mr. Chairman. I think Lee Gerloff has one issue that she'd like to bring to the
Lee, sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Lee Gerloff, Chief of Police Services for the Corrections Division. As we previously testified, the Corrections Division supports the abolishment of the conditional discharge, specifically ORS 421-120, Section 3. The repeal of this section was introduced in House Bill 2086, and we had understood that that was going to be included or incorporated into the omnibus bill. The only thing that I did wish to state was that we would propose that the omnibus bill do provide some appropriate supervision, if supervision is indeed what is intended, or that at least the repeal of the conditional discharge bill be addressed in the omnibus bill.
Okay.
Thank you.
Questions? Okay. Pat, did you have this one?
There is one, excuse me.
Yeah,
great. Regarding the pre-sentence investigations, is it concerned that the language in the law might state that we can do them within 20 or 30 days upon notice of the conviction, so that we're assured that we can meet those time frames rather than if the person is out of custody or out of the jurisdiction, or we don't receive the paperwork from the court notifying us that a pre-sentence is ordered, the clock won't start running until such time as we receive that notice. It's page 6, line 20 to 25.
Your recommended amendment is set for 20 days running following receipt of notice of the conviction.
We could probably say on line 22, notice of the conviction, upon receipt of notice of the conviction, and also on 25.
Okay, thank you. We'll take that amendment under advisement for the work session. Thank you.
Thank you.
Paul Snyder.
Mr. Chair, I can come back on Tuesday.
If that's convenient, fine. We appreciate it, Paul. Billy, would you like to come up now? You're not in the building, I guess, every day, so you'd probably like to be heard now.
Very quickly, Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Billy Wasson, Director of Marion County Community Correction Department. Worked with the interim task force and with other groups. I laud your effort to merge these. I think you've done a good job in this omnibus bill. Three comments in support, really, of the bill. We support the 15-day limit related to jail, both for probation and parole. I think we can make those timelines, particularly with Bob's comment, and we have been working with parole board for some time to locally train hearing officers to assist the parole board. The 20 and 30 day requirement for completion of pre-sentence investigations. I also second Pat's comment about adding that language from some language for receipt of time of notice, because there is sometimes a paper delay in terms of when we get notice that a PSI has been ordered. And of course, the Section 27 on provisions to keep the courts advised of community corrections or community service and so forth, I would support those sections as well, and those were our recommendations. I have no other comments.
Okay. Thank you very much. And thanks, Billy, for your time and meeting earlier and trying to refine those particular provisions that went into this bill.
Thank you.
Linda?
This is not a question, but just for the committee's benefit, so we all have it in mind. Judge Bonebreak just pointed out about the 20 days, using the term of following conviction, that there is not conviction until there's sentencing and a judgment order, and we would need to look at changing that word to something else that's not appropriate use right now.
I would raise one other assumption, maybe it's an informed question. The bill makes reference to the Corrections Division having to adhere to these 20, 30-day limits and so forth. The assumption is, on my part, as a Community Corrections Act county, that we are the Corrections Division in terms of what the legislation is trying to get at. Now, I don't know whether that will ever be questioned or not. And if, upon looking at that, you think that is something that will be questioned, you might want to reference the Corrections Division or someone carrying out the services under ORS 425, which is the Community Corrections Act. Maybe it's a moot issue, but I had noticed that, and some county may be confused as to whether they have to carry out these particular provisions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sandrock? Bill Gray, would you like to help me out also? Maybe the two of you could assume you're pulling someone in harness together.
You're correct, and I'll defer first to Bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bill Gary, Solicitor General. I do have some proposed language changes, mostly dealing with the sections of the bill that incorporate proposals made by the Department of Justice and the District Attorneys Association. Initially, I'd like to make some general comments about the testimony that was heard earlier from the circuit judges, Judge Hargraves and Judge Bonebreak. And I point out, first of all, that they're obviously distinguished members of the bench, and I respect both of them a great deal, because it's a little difficult to say what I have to say in any kind of a delicate way. If I understand the judge's position correctly, it is this.
He's not listening to anyone.
Either let us make the decision as to what the time served is going to be in our unfettered discretion, without any guidance from the legislature or anyone else, or take us out of it. Don't make us cooperate with anyone else in the system. Don't give us any guidelines. Don't make us follow any standards set by the legislature or by anyone else, and don't make our decisions reviewable. If that is their position, then I think that it is going to be necessary for the legislature to respectfully disregard that position and take some other kind of action, because it simply is not a position that can work in any kind of fair and responsible manner in a justice system that has to face the problem of having limited resources and limited facilities to deal with criminal conduct. There are a number of suggestions that they've made and comments that they've made about the other provisions of the bill with which we agree, and suggestions that are good ones, and problems that they pointed out that are problems with drafting that obviously need to be corrected. Specifically, Judge Bonebreak pointed out that the standards criteria for the imposition of consecutive sentences would require the judge to make what he characterized as sociological findings. He pointed out also candidly that those are the kinds of considerations that enter into their decision now as to whether to impose consecutive sentences. And yet he suggested, and Judge Hargrave suggested, that there's going to be a great deal of new litigation occasioned by disagreement over what those criteria mean. I don't understand how you can draft criteria for the imposition of consecutive sentences without referring to those kinds of sociological findings, since the process of sentencing, the process of disposing of convicted criminal offenders, is fundamentally a sociological process. Secondly, it is true that there will be litigation, appellate litigation, as well as trial court litigation, about what those criteria mean and how they should be applied. There ought to be that kind of litigation because that's how the law develops in our system. It isn't going to be new litigation in the sense that it is additional cases to be disposed of. It's going to shift the focus, and I think appropriately shift the focus from where it is now. Now the court deals with the problem of multiple punishments by the doctrine of merger. Instead of talking about what is the appropriate sentence and what are the appropriate criteria that ought to, and how should those criteria be imposed, the court deals with the problem by talking about, did the legislature intend that this person's conduct should be two or more crimes? That's a fiction. Everybody knows it's a fiction. It leads to fundamentally wrong statements about what a person's criminal record is, and it significantly limits the breadth of discretion that judges and the parole board have to respond to criminal conduct appropriately. Judge Hargrave's question whether there should be a requirement of findings recorded in the judgment, and he makes a good point, I think, that including those findings in the judgment may not be the best way of addressing the problem because of what that judgment is used for down the road. There is a need, however, to make sure that the judges make those findings for a lot of the reasons that members of the committee pointed out, because simple fairness requires that the defendant be told why he's getting what he is and somebody else that committed the same crime is getting a different punishment. Because the parole board, whether they choose to disagree with the judge or not, needs to know what the judge's thought process was. And because the judge is in a much better position to make certain kinds of evaluations that the parole board need only speculate about unless they have the benefit of the judge's thinking. We have proposed, and this bill includes, the elimination of the direct review of the sentence imposed by the judge, substituting for it review of the parole board's decision, including the decision to override consecutive sentences or minimum sentences. There needs to be some mechanism by which the findings of the trial court can be communicated to the parole board. And I can only think of two other ways other than incorporating it in the judgment in which it could be done. One is the mechanism that is now provided in Section 16, whereby the parole board receives from the judge what Judge Hargrave called the post-sentence report. You need not include in that sentence report the kinds of material that are included in it now, if indeed there's anything of substance included in it. But it may be a vehicle that you could use to provide the judge with a mechanism outside of the sentence order and outside of the transcript to make that available to that, those thoughts available to the parole board. The other alternative is merely to make the requirement that the judge state his reasons on the record and then require in every case that the record be transcribed and made available to the parole board. And I guess the only basis upon which I can think of to distinguish between those two is administrative convenience and the cost, and I'm not sure which one is the least expensive way of doing it. Judge Hargrave also mentioned that there is a potential constitutional problem and what he later characterized as a philosophical disagreement that he has with having the parole board fix criteria that then govern the way that he imposes his sentence or that would require him to make certain kinds of factual findings. I'm quite familiar with the separation of powers issue that I think he was alluding to, and I really don't see the problem in merely asking the court to make factual findings that subsequently are going to be used by an administrative agency, an agency of the executive branch, in applying, doing its job. And I think that is the kind of inter-branch cooperation that we have to be looking at unless we're going to completely overhaul the system and make it either completely administrative or completely judicial. Judge Hargreaves asked the question regarding consecutive sentences. Who makes the finding in Section 12, sub 3, regarding pause, the renunciation issue, when there are multiple violations of the same statute? And curiously enough, the language that is included in that section is included at the behest of Judge Hargreaves, a criticism that he made of the provision. We're talking anti-merger now, in one of the first hearings. And it was an attempt by the district attorneys in drafting amendments to answer the question of what about the person that repeatedly slugged somebody? Is that many assaults or is it just one assault? It is my interpretation of that provision, and I think it's the intent of the provision, that the question of whether there are one assault or many assaults is a question of fact to be found by the jury upon appropriate instructions from the court, unless there is no evidence from which a reasonable trier of fact could conclude that the defendant had an opportunity to reconsider his course of conduct and elected not to do so. And I don't think that's a very subtle or complicated factual finding for the jury to make. They do it all the time now in the context of a kidnapping rape or a kidnapping robbery, where in order to find the defendant guilty of kidnapping, it is necessary for the jury to conclude that in addition to whatever criminal animus is required for the robbery or the rape, the defendant had a separate and distinct intent to significantly interfere with the liberty of the victim. That same kind of finding of fact regarding the defendant's state of mind would be required in order to find multiple rapes, multiple assaults, or any of the kinds of crimes that can be repeated against the same victim over in a single course of conduct. It may be desirable to specifically state that is to be an element of the crime, a finding by the jury, but I don't think that there's any problem in making that finding or delivering that issue to the jury upon appropriate instructions. I think that was all the notes that I had with respect to their comments. We are continuing to refine the language in the working draft, and I have a couple of proposed amendments, specific proposed amendments. Most of these are designed merely to clarify. None of them change the thrust of what we're proposing. First of all, on page 9.
Well, I'll tell you what. In the interest of time, I wonder if you could. Do you have those in LC form yet?
No, I don't.
I wonder if you might get those refined and provide them to Linda, and I wonder if we could review them with you at our work session.
Yeah,
would that be agreeable?
Yes, I'm trying to figure out whether there's anything. There are no policy issues here, really. They're clarifications, and that's fine.
Okay. Appreciate your help on that. Thank you. Peter, did you have some initial comments? Let me take that, and then I'll see if there are questions of either of you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Pete Sandrock of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. A couple of quick remarks. Judge Hargreaves mentioned his concerns with the language in the anti-merger section 12. Discussing the joint interests in real or personal property. That amendment was another amendment that was added to clarify some issues that Judge Hargreaves raised in an earlier hearing about what happens with the defendant who steals $100 from a major law firm that has 55 partners. If he's stolen from 55 victims and therefore committed 55 thefts. That language was there to answer that particular question. Mr. Gary already mentioned the addition of that language regarding a sufficient pause in the defendant's criminal conduct to afford an opportunity to reconsider that conduct. Once again, to answer Judge Hargrave's concerns. During the process of dealing with this bill, we, at the committee's suggestion, have met on several occasions with members of the committee and with members of the defense bar to work out, particularly in the consecutive sentencing area, what I think were, at least in general concept, acceptable approach to deal rationally with a consecutive sentence situation. And I would hope that, that there is enough agreement in that regard that the committee could dispose of that issue fairly quickly. In terms of the anti-merger situation, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association has submitted, and I just received a copy of it today, their own anti-merger bill, which I believe is an attempt to codify the present law on merger. It would not do that, however. It would work, in my estimation, a gross injustice, looking particularly at Section 2, Subsection 1 of their proposed amendment.